You're listening to Irish Radio Canada's Home and Abroad, and I'm delighted to be connecting with Emma Donoghue. And I had the pleasure and privilege of sitting through what would be Emma's first musical stage creation. And it was at the Blythe Festival, and it's called The Wind Coming Over the Sea. And it is doing so well that Blythe are extending the run, going right out into October. And the six characters, and we'll talk about that shortly, but it's being extended extra performances from September 25th to October 4th. And that's an indication of how popular and how well attended it is. And I also had the opportunity recently reading Haven, a wonderful book about the Skelligs. And Emma will be in Ottawa in September at the Writers' Festival, and that is to talk about her most recent book, which is The Paris Express. And that is on Sunday, September 28th at St. John the Evangelist on Somerset Street, and that's at 7 p.m. And details of that are at writersfestival.org. Emma Tafalteroth, thanks a million for taking the time.
Margaret, nice to be here.
I am always fascinated by the different art forms and the creativity needed to adapt from one to another. So as someone who writes novels and then has done scripts, to jump from that into a musical, was it being a bit of an acrobat?
You know, it's my ninth full-length work for theatre, so I've been doing theatre from the beginning of my career, so that's nothing new, and it's always been the most pleasurable part of my work, actually, because if there's a kind of a spectrum of, say, how sociable work is, you've got novels way over on the lonely side of things, and you've got, film and theatre over on the sociable end. But then with film, you see, the writer doesn't have much power. So I would say theatre is really at that sweet spot where you're still, your words are absolutely honoured, and they will email you to check if they're going to change a pause or a single word. And yet it's hugely social and collaborative. So I absolutely love it. I suppose what is new about The Wind Coming Over the Sea is that it's not the first of my plays to have any songs in it, but it's the first one that I really thought of as a musical, meaning that the story is actually told through the songs. The songs are they're substantial. They're the kind of bones of the piece. In that, when I wanted to write about this couple, the Johnsons, who came over to Canada first, him and then her, I knew that I wanted them to bring, you know, the best of their Irish heritage with them, and I thought, what better to bring them the songs, you know? And so many Irish songs are about those situations that would come up in the show, from emigration to sorrow to love. So I knew that in the folk tradition, I would find songs that would help me tell this story.
And the great thing in the literary world is that the license allows you to take even contemporary songs and bring them back 150 years or any of music anywhere in between, because it's telling the story as distinct from having to be chronologically correct in music.
Yes, though, I think, I'm trying to remember, I think of all the songs are traditional in The Wind Coming Over the Sea, and I think the latest we have is maybe, some of the lyrics are early 20th century, but they're all from the folk tradition, even if in a couple of cases we know who wrote them, like there's a British hymn, for instance, we know the name of the author of that. But those early songs, and some of them I would say date from about the 18th century, what I love about them is how unsentimental they are. You know, Sometimes the kind of folk music that was written by individual songwriters in the 20th century could lay on the sorrow and the schmaltz a bit thick, but I find the really old ones are very bare bones. They're kind of like, I did a crime, I got transported, I ended up in Australia, you know, or my children died, you know. They're very stark. So I absolutely love that bare bones vibe that the true folk tradition brings.
Because it's a play and it's a musical, what was fabulous and powerful was that all the actors were musicians. And I'm going to point my finger at one, and that is at George Meanwell.
I knew you were going to say George. He's astounding. He's primarily a cellist in his musician life. He's played with, say, Yo-Yo Ma. But his skill at instruments is such that halfway through rehearsals, Anne, our musical director, said, George, I think this one would be lovely on the harp. And he said, sorry, I've never played the harp. And she was like, have a go. So he picked up harp for this show. Jeffrey Armour learned the flute in preparation for the show once he knew he'd been cast. They played so many different instruments. And this was partly, you know, when you're planning any show, you want to make it relatively affordable. So I said to Gil Garrett, our artistic director and the director of the play, look, I don't want a separate band of musicians. I would love it if by any chance the actors could, you know, do the music themselves if they're not busy singing. Could that be? And he said, oh, we only hire that kind of actor in Blythe. You know, so many plays at Blythe have this element of music to them. He said, we will have no trouble getting amazing singers and musicians. And that gives the whole thing a lovely, it's an improvised quality. I mean, the play is not improvised, but when you've got an actor, you know, acting a character and then just picking up an accordion and going straight into accompanying the next scene, it gives a lovely sort of homespun feel to it. And something else that increased that sense of intimacy is that Gil Garrett decided to put 26 of the audience on stage in rows of seats, so that especially the scenes of the ship, there are two big ship scenes, you have that feeling of like, here we all are in steerage together, you know, making music to pass the time. And the audience, even in the big auditorium, they feel encouraged to join in with the clapping and singing and so on. I had a Northern Irish couple beside me who sang every song. They knew them all, even though a lot of them are relatively obscure ones. They're not Molly Malone, you know. They're songs like The Banks of the Ban, which some would know, but not everybody. So to see the audience respond so much and to see the music really pulling them in, you know, making them feel it was their story too, that was just wonderful.
So in putting this together, Emma, then, did you research any particular family and trace them to...
Yes, the whole thing is inspired by a set of letters, and there's a kind of a core set of seven letters between Jane McConnell Johnson and her husband Henry Johnson. And I came across them in a footnote on a book about the famine emigrants to Canada. And these letters are not only incredibly poignant in the sort of story they tell, but they're very well written. These were very articulate, educated Presbyterian shopkeepers. And, you know, they're not only full of concrete details in their letters. You know, he'll say things like, P.S., bring the gun. Or, you know, he'll specify the price of wheat. But also they're very emotionally articulate. Henry, as a character, clearly he was slightly ne'er-do-well by Presbyterian standards in that, you know, he had a bit of a drinking problem. And he's constantly writing back from Canada saying, like, any day now I'll have a good job and be able to send money. You know, the months and months are going by because times were hard in Canada too. But Henry will say things like, at the end of his letter, he'll say, please forgive anything wrong I've said in this letter. You know, I'll never manage to settle anywhere without you. So it was a very emotionally literate marriage, I would say. And then around this set of seven letters, you have letters from their family over several decades. And I used a lot of the letters of Jane's father, who, you know, decade after decade is writing off to his three daughters in Canada, sending them money, wishing them well, asking how they make their cheese, congratulating them on the birth of a child. It's such a moving source. And all these letters are at the University of Western Ontario in London, Ontario, where I live. So yeah, the play is, you know, it's not verbatim. I wrote all the monologues and scenes, but it's very much inspired by individual lines in a lot of these letters from the 1840s through to about the 1870s.
So if you say theatre is a sweet spot, could you see yourself, or are you working towards more stage work?
I would say it's become... I'd like to have something theatrical going on every year now. Yeah, after many years in which I would say I did mostly fiction and film. I think a breakthrough show for me was the theatre adaptation of Room. It for instance, that got me to the Abbey Theatre in Ireland. To have a show on in the national theatre of your native land, you know, there's nothing like it. And that one also had a wonderful production in Canada with the Grand Theatre and Mirvish. So I think that one helped sort of reinvigorate my theatre career. Yeah, yeah. And also, as you get more established in your career, what you really want are these experiences that make you enormously happy. And, you know, writing novels has always been my main job, but it is a bit of a solitary grind at times. So having an ongoing theatre collaboration as well is hugely energising and great fun.
When you do talk of solitary grind, that does kind of lead into Haven. That's very
fun. Which is entirely about the solitary grind of being monks on an island. That's right, yes.
And
yes,
writing.
And imagining.
And
yeah,
writing.
Yeah, the first three monks to settle on Skellig Michael. And the funny thing is, their job was writing in the sense of transcribing their copy of the gospel. That's mostly what these monasteries did. And I remember a chapter in which the young monk is getting more and more sick of the writing process and literally the grind that he's making his ink, he's preparing the vellum and so forth. And I remember thinking, this is a metaphor for novel writing, because there's a moment in every book where you're just like, how did I ever get into this book? I'm sick to the back teeth of the specialist knowledge that I need to write this book. Who will ever want to read it? Yes. We all have moments of doubt.
And of course, while again with the like Haven, it gives you have that literary freedom, because you're able to create the characters. All you needed was, in effect, the backdrop of the Skelligs.
Absolutely, and not just a backdrop, but that Haven is the only novel of mine that's quite inspired by an archaeological report, in that I used the detailed report on the archaeological digs on Skellig Michael. Dad told me things like what plants there were on the island. So I wasn't just making up random stuff. I was mentioning the particular things that they had. And I remember thinking, I want there to be at least one tree on the island, because yes. I had this vision in my mind that the sort of evil boss abbot would cut down the one tree. You know, I was also inspired by Waiting for Godot there, the idea of in Act One there's a tree, in Act Two there's no tree. So I remember thinking, what tree could possibly have been growing on there? And in the archaeological dig, they mention rowan. They found seeds of rowan. And I was like, OK, perfect. I'll have a rowan tree. So, that was a hugely helpful source. And it told me things like in what order they built things. Because, of course, they modified the island in many interesting ways. They did dug, you know, steps into the cliffs and had landing places and built, you know, huts to live in and huts to pray in and so on. So, that was, I suppose, that's one of my only novels that's been inspired so much by a particular place. Yeah. And sometimes when I've written, it's been places, say, my last novel set in Paris. But in the case of Haven, it was set in such a very small and very specific place. Yeah.
In every context, because even while it may have traversed or come down from another part of Ireland, it's everywhere was very confined. The other monasteries and everything was confined rather than it being expansive.
Absolutely. And what's funny is that, you know, usually when you're writing a sort of an adventure story, so people going on a journey and settling in a new place, they're usually trying to make their lives better. You know, like in the case of the Johnsons coming from Ireland to Canada in the 1840s, they're like, they want more calories for their children. They want a chance of a better life. In the case of monks in the year 600 going to Skellig Michael, they're basically trying to make their lives harder. So it's like almost a weird inverse of an adventure story, where they set out from a relatively comfortable, you know, men and women monastery with fine meals, you know, and they're looking for a place where their life will be harder. So the whole thing was a great way of sort of investigating Celtic spirituality at its most sort of austere and punitive, but then also its moments of sort of radiant connection with nature and with solitude too.
Well, I've just finished reading another book which jumps between time of Nafiana and the future. And
wow.
Warwick, yeah, it's fascinating that there's time travellers that are able to come from the Fianna up to the present time, but draw on technology from the future. An amazing concept. So the Paris Express that you're going to be here in Ottawa on September 28th, that's on the shelves. And tell us a little about it.
That's about a very particular train journey. Yeah, it's based on a famous train disaster from October 22nd, 1895, so 130 years ago now. And what was extraordinary about it wasn't so much how much damage was done as the fact that it was captured in photographs. So it's a very modern disaster in that it became this iconic image flashed around the world. Newspapers didn't put photographs directly in, but they did engravings based on them, and they would add little details to sort of soup it up. So you've got this image of this crashing train, and then the newspaper artists would add a person in the foreground fleeing with their arms in the air, you know. So I wrote it because I was going to Paris for a year, and we were staying in the area of Montparnasse, and I literally just Googled what happened in Montparnasse, and I found this extraordinary train disaster. And I'd been interested for some time in writing about a disaster because I like the idea that all these total strangers would be brought together by the same terrible thing happening to them one day. So I decided early on that the rules of the book for me would be, you know, it only lasts the same length of time as the train journey. So it goes from, you know, when people are getting on board in the town of Granville in Normandy on the coast at about 8 a.m. through to about 4 o'clock when it hit Paris. And it has lots of characters, but it's very tightly confined to the train. And soon I realized that unlike 20th century train, it wouldn't have toilets. It wouldn't have any kind of restaurant car or food trolley. And above all, it doesn't have corridors. You couldn't walk between carriages. So, you know, if you think of, say, classic Hitchcock films, you know, the characters are always running between or hiding in different carriages. But in 1895, you were stuck in your train carriage until the train stopped. So that gave a very interesting kind of musical chairs rhythm to the Paris Express as a novel, because my characters are sort of sit tight for maybe a long stretch while the train is moving. And then when it stops at stations, everyone gets to sort of jump out or change where they're sitting or interact with each other. So yes, I really enjoyed that one. And it has a kind of thriller-like quality because there's a bomb on the train, just to give them a kind of a double jeopardy. And I just loved the process of moving between the minds of all these different characters, and including people from all over the world, because unlike many historical novels, 1890 was a multinational culture. You know, I was effortlessly able to bring in people from all the continents. And I decided to have at least an Irish character. So I decided to, you know, I was using characters who were people who were around in 1895 and could plausibly have been on my train, as well as the ones who really were. So I decided that the young John Singh, before he becomes the famous playwright, he was like a student drifter in Paris living off the odd boiled egg, you know, very little food. And I thought he could easily be on this train. I quite like to catch people, you know, before they become famous, when they're still unformed.
Emma, we'll wrap it up. And as I said, you will be here in Ottawa September 28th, and that's at 7 p.m. at St. John the Evangelist. And tickets for that are available at writersfestival.org. Do you have any other appearances that your book readings coming up in the near future around the province?
My next film, H is for Hawk, should be out not too long from now. We've cast the wonderful Irish actor Brendan Gleeson in it as the father of Helen MacDonald, who's the it's based on her book, her memoir about bereavement, and Claire Foy will play Helen MacDonald. So that's going to be a gorgeous film. And you mentioned the Blythe Play Extension. I just want to say it actually runs till the 5th, so September 25th to October 5th. Yep. The Wind Coming Over the Sea is coming back to Blythe, so hope a few of your listeners can get to that one.
Hopefully indeed. Emma Donoghue, it's been a real honour and pleasure chatting with you again.
Thanks, Austin.